Welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 645 of the Divine Intervention Life Lessons, Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, we're going to be continuing the 386 series. This is going to be series 7. We're going to start from question 157. So, a 28-year-old white woman returns to the office for follow-up of hypertension. She says, "My blood pressure keeps getting worse no matter what I do." Her hypertension had been controlled with a diuretic and a beta-blocking medication for 4 years, but her blood pressure has steadily increased in the past 8 months, despite taking maximum doses of the medications. She insists she takes her medications as directed. Family history is negative for hypertension. She does not smoke cigarettes. Height is 5 feet 4 inches, that's 163 centimeters, and weight is 75 kilograms, that's 165 pounds. The BMI is 28 kilograms per meter squared. Vital signs today are a pulse of 96 per minute and blood pressure of 165 over 110, standing in both arms. Examination of the retina shows AV nicking. Abdominal examination discloses a new epigastric bruit. The remainder of the examination is normal. Right, so we look at this question and we see this person, she's a young female, right? And she seems to have this resistant hypertension, and it seems to have developed, you know, things seem to have been getting worse over the past 8 months, right? And she has this AV nicking, right? Arteriovenous nicking in the eye. We tend to see that in people that have really nasty hypertension. And we also see she has an epigastric bruit. So what condition should you be thinking about here? I really hope you're thinking about some kind of renal vascular disease, like fibromuscular dysplasia, right? So now we just need to pick an answer choice that relates to fibromuscular dysplasia, right? So question 57 says, which of the following is the most appropriate diagnostic study to order next? Option A says, 24-hour urine collection for creatinine clearance and protein excretion. No, right? We typically are going to do that for nephrotic or nephritic syndrome. Option B says, 24-hour urinary collection for vanillyl mandelic acid, metanephrine, and catecholamine excretion. We're going to typically do that for pheochromocytoma. That's not what's going on here. Option C says serum and urine electrolyte concentrations. That's a very, very non-specific answer, right? Like, it's very non-specific, right? It can apply to almost anything. And then option D says serum TSH, cortisol, and aldosterone concentrations. Well, you'd be doing these if you're worried about, like, Kahn syndrome or Cushing syndrome or hyperthyroidism as the cause of her high blood pressure. But again, this question is not talking about that, right? So option E says urinalysis and serum creatinine and urea nitrogen concentrations. Absolutely, right? So I'm going to go with option E here because it can help us evaluate her renal function, right, to see if it's abnormal, right? Because if you have fibromuscular dysplasia or it's close causing in the older individual renal artery stenosis, you'll have abnormalities in those labs. All right. So question 58 says, which of the following is the most appropriate imaging study? Well, option A says abdominal CT scan with contrast. B says abdominal ultrasound. C says adrenal MRI. D says radionuclide thyroid scan. E says renal duplex ultrasonography, right? So again, we want to go with what is can help us evaluate the renal arteries. The renal arteries, you can evaluate them very easily with ultrasound, right? So I'm going to go with option E. The thing is, one other answer that may have been a little confusing here is like CT angiography of the renal arteries or MR angiography of the renal arteries. But typically, that's something you're going to do after you've done the renal duplex ultrasound, right? So I'm going to go with option E here. Abdominal CT scan with contrast, again, pretty non-specific. Many pathologies go with that. Abdominal ultrasound, again, pretty non-specific, many pathologies go with that. And an abdominal ultrasound, I know, may not be the smartest way to evaluate the renal arteries itself, right? You want to go with a more specific answer here, which is going to be option E. Adrenal MRI is for, like, you know, a person having Cushing syndrome where they have, like, an adrenal adenoma or something. That's not what's going on here. And then radionuclide thyroid scan, that's a RIU scan, right? That's for a thyroid pathology, which is not what's going on in this lady. All right. Now, question 59 says, a 27-year-old nolly-gravid woman returns to the office to discuss results of a pap smear obtained 2 weeks ago during a health maintenance examination. At that time, physical examination, including pelvic examination, disclosed no abnormalities. The patient's menstrual periods occur at regular 28-day intervals. She has been in a stable relationship with the same man for 3 years, and she uses a diaphragm with spermicidal jelly for contraception. A pap smear obtained 3 years ago showed no abnormalities. Pap smear obtained at her last visit shows evidence of marked inflammation, suggestive of a high-grade squamous intraepithelial lesion. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step, right? So this person has a pap smear and it showed a high-grade squamous intraepithelial lesion, right? This is worrisome, right? And I think I may have discussed this in a previous podcast, but I have definitely discussed this in a previous podcast, but whenever a person has an abnormal pap smear, right, especially if they have like a CIN or, you know, atypical squamous cells of, if they have like a ASCH or any of those things, I have a pap smear podcast you should listen to. You should go ahead and do a colposcopy, right? So we're going to pick the answer that talks about colposcopy. I hope there's an answer like that. All right. So option A says, advise the patient that our partner should use condoms for contraception and repeat the pap smear in 3 months. No. Right? Whenever you have an abnormal pap smear, you always have to follow it up with a colposcopy, and the specifics about that, again, listen to my pap smear podcast. And then option B says, do colposcopic examination of the cervix after application of 5% acetic acid solution. That's definitely the right answer. I'm going to pick option B. Option C says, do colonization of the cervix. I would not do that next, right? So remember, you get an abnormal pap smear, your next step is to get a colposcopy. And the colposcopy is like microscopy of the cervix. And then based on those abnormal colposcopy results, you then choose a biopsy method like colonization or cryotherapy or a LEAP procedure, a loop electroexcision procedure, right? So again, option C is the third step in the trajectory, not the second step. Option B is the second step. And then option D says, reassure the patient and repeat the pap smear in 3 months. No, this is worrisome findings, high grade. You got to do something. Option E says, treat the patient with metronidazole for 2 weeks. No, we're not trying to treat like bacterial vaginosis here. No. So the right answer is going to be option B. All right. So question 60 says, a 46-year-old man with Marfan syndrome, aortic insufficiency, and mitral regurge comes to the emergency department because he has had severe substernal chest pain for the past 3 hours. He describes the pain as tearing in quality and radiating to the neck. 1 week earlier, he experienced similar but less severe chest pain and treated himself with aspirin. Which of the following is the most likely underlying cause for his worsening symptoms? Well, we know that a person that has Marfan's, they can have aortic problems. They can have aortic dissection, right, because of the cystic medial necrosis, right? So they can have a tear in the intima that rips into the media and causes problems, right? So this person probably has aortic dissection, right? And the thing is, taking aspirin may not be the smartest idea, at least in that acute phase, right? Because again, aspirin is an antiplatelet drug. It's going to cause more bleeding. It's going to cause more bleeding into the media, right? That may explain why his symptoms are worsening, right? So option A says acute bacterial endocarditis. That's wrong, right? Endocarditis is going to present with fever, right? A new murmur and things like that. We don't see that here. Option B says acute MI. An acute MI can cause a sudden onset chest pain, right? But again, in a Marfan's person that has aortic problems, probably not. Right? At least that's just not the most likely answer. Option C says dissection of the aorta. Yeah, that's the right answer there. Option D says esophageal reflux with spasm. Well, it's not going to be causing these kinds of very severe symptoms. And then option E says a perforated peptic ulcer. Well, we'll have a question stem that talks about like free under the diaphragm or signs of peritonitis like rigidity, rebound guarding. We don't see that here, right? So I'm going to go with option C for this one. All right, so let's go to question 61. 30-year-old man who has been your patient for several years, comes to the office for a periodic health evaluation. He has been healthy, but has a birth defect involving his hands and feet. He is missing the second and third metatarsals, metacarpals, and corresponding fingers and toes. He has three healthy children, and no one else in the family has this condition. He has adapted well to his condition. During your evaluation, he asks, what do you think? If I have any more kids, will they have hands and feet like mine? You review the family history and his pedigree, which is shown. His physical examination is otherwise normal. In addition to discussing your opinions with him, which of the following is the most appropriate next step? Right. So if we look at this pedigree, he's the only one that has the problem. No sibling has the problem. No parent has the problem. No distant relative has the problem. No child has the problem. Right. So when you look at something like this, it kind of tells us that, OK, this is not a heritable condition. This is probably something that happens from some kind of sporadic mutation. Right. Or from some injury during reproductive development. Right. So, you know, like, for example, phocomelia, right, from a thalidomide. Right. Can affect the limbs, can affect the digits. Right. Or even like a person having like there are many things that can cause like injury, right, during limb development in utero. Right. So this is not a heritable condition. His kids are not going to get it. He's had three kids already. None of them have any issues, right? So again, it's a sporadic issue. So it's probably not even a mutation at all. It's probably like just some injury from some agent that he got exposed to in utero, right? So skin biopsy for fibroblast culture, that's wrong, right? That's wrong. No. Other chromosome analysis of peripheral blood lymphocytes, no. Other radionuclide scan of his hands and feet, No. Other skeletal x-ray surveys of his three children? No. Right? Again, this is not a heritable thing he has, right? So option E, I like option E a lot. Order no additional tests at this time. All right, so again, just look at the pedigree. Like, this is a pretty simple question that they're just trying to make look harder than it needs to be. All right, so question 62 says, a 75-year-old woman, and again, just quick pro tip, right? Don't overcomplicate questions on your exams, right? That's what gets a lot of people in trouble. Just analyze it simply. Pick the answer that is the simple answer and move along. All right, so a 75-year-old woman comes to the office because she has band-like burning pain in her right upper abdomen, extending from the epigastrium around to the midline of the back. Physical examination discloses no abdominal tenderness to palpation. Findings on ultrasonography of the gallbladder are normal. Serum amylase concentration is within the reference range. Which of the following is the most likely diagnosis? So option A says acalculus cholecystitis. B says chronic relapsing pancreatitis. C says diverticulitis of the cecum. D says herpes zoster. And then E says penetrating duodenal ulcer. Right, so okay, so this person's amylase is fine. Ultrasonography of the gallbladder is fine. So this person probably doesn't have acute pancreatitis, right? So, because remember, in acute pancreatitis, you have like epigastric pain radiating to the back, right? You have elevated amylase or lipase, right? And you can have like CT findings, right? Imaging findings consistent with pancreatitis. This person literally checks off none of those boxes, right? So, okay, maybe other than the epigastric pain going to the back, right? So, but you need 2 out of 3 of those things. She only has 1 out of 3, right? So she doesn't have pancreatitis, right? So get rid of option B. And then diverticulitis of the cecum will likely cause like right lower quadrant pain, right? Because the cecum is in the right lower quadrant, right? So that's wrong. That's not where she has pain. Option D says herpes zoster. I'm going to go with that because she's 75 years old, right? She's 75 years old, like band-like pain, right? Band-like pain in a specific dermatome, right? That makes sense for herpes zoster. Option E says penetrating duodenal ulcer. I would not pick that. You know why? Because again, you have signs of peritonitis because that's usually associated with like rupture and things like that. She may be coughing up blood, you know, things like that. We don't see that. Acalculus cholecystitis is going to be a burn patient, ICU patient, or burn patient, ICU patient, very septic patient, right? Having biliary problems, they will have like fever and all those things. We don't see that here, so I'm not gonna pick that one. All right, so the answer is gonna be option D, herpes zoster. All right, so question 63 says a 19-year-old woman comes to the emergency department because she says, I'm burning up. She's known to staff as an intravenous drug user. Physical examination discloses a systolic heart murmur over the precordium. An expected physical finding will be which of the following, right? So what does this patient have? Well, this person has endocarditis, right? And being an IV drug user, what's going to be the most likely kind of endocarditis she has? Probably has like tricuspid valve endocarditis. Because remember, if you're an intravenous drug user, you're injecting drugs into your veins. Well, if you inject bugs into your veins, what's the first valve that is hit when blood enters into the heart? It's going to be the tricuspid valve, right? So it makes sense that she likely has tricuspid valve endocarditis, right? So she probably has tricuspid valve endocarditis, right? So like a right-sided heart valve problem, right? So what physical exam finding are we going to see? Option A says decreased intensity of S1. No, that's actually wrong, because if you have a murmur, right? If you have a murmur, because remember, S1 is closure of the mitral and tricuspid valve, right? So because she has a murmur, she has like turbulent flow and all those things through the valve, you're going to have an increased intensity. So that's wrong. Option B says increased intensity of the murmur with deep inspiration. Okay, so when you inspire, you put down your diaphragm, you lower your diaphragm. So that's going to reduce intrathoracic pressure, right? Because intrathoracic volume is going up. So that's going to increase venous return. If you have increased venous return, you will have more flow through right-sided heart valves, right? Because literally more blood is coming back to the right side of the heart, right? So you have increased blood flow. So if she has a murmur, she has a valvular issue from the endocarditis, yes, that will give you you will have a louder sound with that. So let's keep option B. I like option B actually quite a bit. Option C says increased intensity of the murmur with forced expiration. That's wrong, right? It's kind of like the opposite of inspiration, right? When you expire, you're bringing your diaphragm up, your intrathoracic volume is going down, So intrathoracic pressure is going up. That's going to reduce venous returns. There's going to be less flow through the right-sided heart valves. So the murmur intensity should actually decrease, not increase. So C is definitely wrong. Option D says positive co-small sign, right? Rising jugular venous pressure with inspiration. This is something we tend to see in constrictive pericarditis on the USMLE exams. This is not a constrictive pericarditis question. This is an endocarditis question, so that's wrong. And then option E says a right-sided gallop. That's pretty non-specific, right? That's pretty non-specific. So I'm definitely going to go to option B for the reasons I explained, right? Because of the increased venous return to the right side of the heart. All right, now, question 64 says, a 26-year-old woman comes to the office because of fever, cough, and increasing shortness of breath for the past 3 days. She has been living in homeless shelters and says she uses intravenous drugs. She recently tested positive for HIV infection. She takes no medications and has no history of asthma, pneumonia, or tuberculosis. Her last medical evaluation was 5 years ago. Her temperature is 39 degrees Celsius or 102.2 degrees Fahrenheit. Pulse is 100 per minute. Respirations are 28 per minute. And blood pressure is 110 over 60 millimeters of mercury. Auscultation of the chest discloses crackles and ronchi posteriorly over the right lower lung field with tubular breath sounds and dullness to percussion. No sputum could be obtained due to splinting of the chest wall. Chest x-ray shows consolidation of the right lower lobe. Complete blood count and arterial blood gas analysis while breathing room air show. So blood, hematocrit is 36%, hemoglobin is 12.7. That doesn't seem very bad. Y count is 7,800. Neutrophil segmented is 70%, bands 16%. So she has a bandemia, right? Lymphocytes 14%. And then her ABG is PO2 is 72, that's low. PCO2 33, that's low. pH is 7.44. It's not too bad. So which of the following is the most likely diagnosis, right? So again, remember, whenever you say a pneumonia question on your exams, what should your approach be? First thing is, hey, what's the patient population? That's number one. Number two, actually, number one should be, what's the pattern of pneumonia? Is it lobar or is it interstitial, right? Is it lobar or is it interstitial? This is a lobar pneumonia, right? So again, that's very helpful information because knowing that it's a lobar pneumonia, you can promptly get rid of option A. Legionnaire's disease, Legionella pneumophila, does not... Typically, is on the exam, it's going to cause interstitial pneumonia. It can cause lobar pneumonia, but typically it will cause interstitial pneumonia, right? So, and we're going to see like the humidifier exposure, air conditioning systems, and things like that, you know, contaminated water supply. That's not what's here. So A is wrong. Option B is also wrong. Pneumonia caused by pneumocystis jirovetsi causes an interstitial pneumonia on your exam. So that's definitely wrong, right? And then option D says a PE. That doesn't make any sense, right? That's wrong, right? That's not going to be causing fever and all these infiltrates on a chest radiograph. And then option E says pulmonary TB. Again, pulmonary TB, don't get me wrong, could that be what's going on? Yes. But this sudden in presentation, probably not, right? Probably not. And TB usually is going to cause like the upper lobe problems. You're going to see the cavitary lesion. We don't see that here. So that's wrong, right? So I'm going to go to option C. And actually, just epidemiologically, the most common cause, very high yield, the most common cause of lobar pneumonia in HIV patients is going to be strep pneumo. It's going to be strep pneumo. All right. Now, question 65 says, a 60-year-old man, and again, we see the bandemia, right? That tells us that, oh, this is probably a person that has a bacterial infection, right? Which strep pneumo is. All right. So question 65 says a 60-year-old man had a total thyroidectomy and excision of enlarged left jugular lymph nodes for follicular carcinoma. The operation was uncomplicated. He is receiving intravenous 5% dextrose and 0.45% saline with potassium. 12 hours after the operation, he develops circumoral numbness and paresthesias in his fingertips, and he becomes very anxious. Vital signs are a temperature of 37.6, that's 99.7, pulse is 90 per minute, respirations are 16 per minute, and blood pressure is 140 over 90 millimeters of mercury. Physical examination discloses a dry neck dressing and no strider. Extremities are warm with brisk capillary refill time. Additional physical examination is most likely to show which of the following, right? So this is a very classic illness script, right? You do thyroid surgery and then the person is not doing well after said thyroid surgery. Let me ask you this. Is there something that is behind the thyroid that you can inadvertently devascularize or destroy while you're doing thyroid surgery? Yep, it's the parathyroid gland, right? And the thing is, once your parathyroids are gone, your PTH is gone, you're going to have hypocalcemia, right? That's why this person has these numbness and paresthesias, right? So we basically have to pick a hypocalcemia sign here, right? So option A says a Babinski sign present bilaterally. That's wrong, right? That's for upper motor neuron problems. Option B says the Zvostek sign. Yes, I'm going to go with the Zvostek sign, right? Remember, classic signs of hypocalcemia, the Zvostek sign, you tap the cheek and the person will have facial muscle spasms. Another classic one is the Trousseau sign where you put a blood pressure cuff around the arm, and you notice the person has carpopedal spasms, right? I'm definitely going to go to option B here. Option C says deviation of the tongue to the left side. This will be a medial medullary stroke, right? A left medial medullary stroke, you know, like a problem with the cranial nerve 12, the hypoglossal nerve, right? The tongue deviates towards the side of the lesion. That's not what's going on here. Option D says a drooping left shoulder, a droopy shoulder, right? You're going to see that, again, if you have a problem with like cranial nerve 11, your spinal accessory nerve, that's not what's going on here. Hyporeflexia is super non-specific. Again, be careful of these super non-specific answers on your exams. That doesn't usually lead to a good outcome for many people in my experience, right? So, and you may be like, Divine, how do you know this presentation so quickly? Well, the thing is, again, number one, you should have studied this. But number two, I remember when I did my surgery rotation at Hopkins back in the day, I did rotate on an endocrine surgery service for like a month. So this was something we were always concerned and worried about. So yeah, I've certainly seen this, like, you know, before we finish our thyroid surgeries, then we'll just go and check a serum PTH or check a serum calcium level just to be sure, just to dot our I's and cross our T's, right? So I'm going to go with option B here. All right, but even if you never rotated on an endocrine surgery service, this is something you should know if you've studied. All right, so last question today, question 66. A two-year-old African-American child with sickle cell disease is brought to the ED by her parents because of painful swelling of her feet for the past 3 hours. Her temperature is at 37 degrees Celsius, right? So that's 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Physical examination shows swelling and tenderness of her feet. No other abnormal findings were noted. Results of lab studies are shown, right? So the hemoglobin is 7.8. That's pretty low. But it makes sense. She's got sickle cell disease. White count is 13,000. That's kind of high, right? It's over 11,000, right? So it's high. Neutrophil segmented 60%, lymphocytes 40%. Which of the following is the most likely diagnosis, right? So this is a person that has sickle cell disease. They have like really bad, you know, sudden pain in some extremity, right? This is going to be a sickle cell pain crisis, right? And again, you get those pain crises because of ischemia, right? Ischemia hurts, right? When a person has an MI, their chest hurts, right? Because of the ischemia, right? Ischemia literally hurts. It literally hurts. And why do people that have sickle cell disease have ischemia? Well, the thing is, those are sickle cells. They can occlude vessels, right? Just their anatomy, their orientation makes it more likely that they will occlude vessels, right? So they can occlude vessels, right? So they can occlude vessels. So we need to pick the answer that talks about like vessel occlusion or something like that, right? So option A, bone infarction, that seems like a slam dunk answer, right? We're going to pick option A, but let's look at the other answers first. Option B says E. coli sepsis. That's wrong, right? Remember, E. coli sepsis has an association with having a essential galactosemia, right? Remember, the most common cause of death in those kids is E. coli sepsis, right? Remember, essential galactosemia is a deficiency in galactose 1-phosphate uridyl transferase, right? So that's not what's going on here. Pneumococcal sepsis, again, no. Right, and again, look at this, right? 3 hours. You cannot just like be sitting down and then get pneumococcal sepsis in 3 hours, right? That'll be quite the unfortunate person. No, right? Option D says osteomyelitis. Again, can be osteomyelitis, but again, this person does not have fever, right? And this person's symptoms develop very, very rapidly. It's like hyper rapid, right? So it's probably not what's going on here, right? Option E says staphylococcal sepsis. That's going to be wrong, right? So I'm going to go with option A here, bone infarction. I'm going to go with a bone infarction for this one, right? So now, again, if you like the way I teach, you like the way I teach, you like the way I make integrations, you're gonna just absolutely love my classes. You're just gonna what? Absolutely love my classes, right? So I have classes that begin, God willing, next week, Thursday. I have a test-taking class for step 1-3. It's 2.5 hours long. And then on Friday, I have a biostatistics class for step 1-3. It's 4 hours long. And then I have a 5-hour class on Saturday, social sciences, quality improvement, healthcare systems. It's for step 1-3, you know, ethics. I go over that 5-hour class, very high yield class. And then after that, I have a last minute review for step 2 and step 3 alone, right? That's going to be taking place, you know, on Sunday. And then after that, I have a 20-hour course that begins right after that. I have a 20-hour class that begins right after that. I do have a 20-hour class that begins right after that. Again, many people have taken these classes and found them to be extremely helpful, right? Make integrations, I explain pathophysiology, I show you. And the thing is, it's not just a lecture like, oh, show up like, okay, what's the definition of this? No, I don't do that, right? Because that's kind of a waste of your time and my time, right? What I do is I use literally questions to go through the concepts, right? To comprehensively go through the concepts. And then I also have a 25-hour step 1 class that many people have taken and found to be helpful. And then I have a 50-hour step 2, step 3 class taking place in the first 2 weeks of June. That's the only time that's going to take place this year. very limited spots available for that class, but it's a very high level class. Many people have taken advantage to be extremely helpful. It is an extremely wonderful class. And again, these classes, they're over Zoom. You can take them anywhere, right, in the comfort of your home, right? And I'm the person that teaches the whole class, right? It's not like some teaching assistant or whatever that's doing the teaching. And then I also offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLEs and all the complex exams, and also help with ERAS applications, mock interviews, personal statements, you know, editing those things and stuff like that. Again, I worked with many people this past cycle, and a lot of people I worked with matched, right, into very competitive specialties, very competitive programs. And then I also have these podcasts on Apple, Google, and Spotify, so check those out. I also have a YouTube channel that I post the podcasts and videos that I make. And then also another website I have is DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com, DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Many of you know I'm a Christ follower, right, so every week I post like one or two podcasts where from a biblical perspective I address a life lesson. So you can check that out. I actually have an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. So thank you for joining me today. I'll see you, God willing, in episode 646. Have a wonderful day. God bless you, and bye for now. Thank you.